Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today in WILL AM 580. Our guest today, one of the most distinguished professors and scholars of communication of our times, joining us to talk for the full hour about politics and media today in the United States, Dan Schiller, professor from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, our guest today on Media Matters. But first, the NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The United Nations Security Council is to meet within the hour on Friday's massacre in Syria. It happened in an area known as Hula, northwest of the city of Homs. Gunmen attacked a string of Sunni Muslim villages, killing at least 90 people. The UN says among the dead were 32 children under the age of 10. The Syrian ministry denies its troops were responsible. It claims the killings were the work of heavily armed gunmen who also attacked army positions. A Syrian general who also happens to be the head of that country's Olympic Committee boasted yesterday he'll be leading the Syrian delegation at this summer's London Games. But as Larry Miller reports, the British government may have other ideas.
Britain considers those taking part in the Assad regime's violent crackdown on civilians as potentially guilty of human rights violations. Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg told the BBC new legislation makes it possible to keep them out of Britain regardless of any Olympic connection.
If you've abused human rights, that's shown to be the case. You are not welcome in this country.
The London Olympic Committee must submit the names of all participants and officials to the government for approval before they can receive credentials. A ban would not extend to Syrian athletes since they are exempt from military service. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
It's been a deadly Memorial Day weekend in Afghanistan. Four NATO soldiers have died in separate roadside bomb explosions in the south. And NPR's Quill Lawrence reports NATO is investigating claims that an airstrike has killed 8 civilians, including 6 children.
Officials in the province of Paktia say a U.S. airstrike destroyed a house, killing an entire family. The Paktia governor's office said local police were not informed of the attack. U.S. officials often do not tell local authorities about planned raids for fear of leaks. Senior Afghan government officials often won't admit if they have authorized U.S. airstrikes because of public anger. NATO officials said they were aware of the allegations and are investigating the possibility of civilian deaths. NATO did not release the nationalities of the soldiers killed in roadside bomb attacks. Improvised bombs are the weapon of choice for the Taliban, but they are indiscriminate and often kill civilians. Quill Lawrence, NPR News, Kabul.
It's not even a full tropical storm, but a system called Beryl is putting a damper on Memorial Day weekend activities along the coast of Georgia, South Carolina, and Florida. It's a subtropical storm. It's expected to come ashore later today in Jacksonville, Florida. Mayor Alvin Brown says people should take this storm seriously.
I'm encouraging all area residents to stay indoors and off the streets as the storm hits. With the increased risk of rip currents, we're urging everyone to stay out of the water.
Besides rip currents, he warns the storm could bring down trees and power lines and cause some flooding. This is NPR News from Washington. It's Fleet Week in New York City.
He was the famous trumpet man from Mount Chicago way. He had a boogie style.
That's the Manhattan Dolls at one of the many events to honor visiting Navy, Marine, and Coast Guard sailors.
He's in the Army now, I'm blowing reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B.
New York has held Fleet Week every year since 1984. The festivities include dozens of military demonstrations and public tours of visiting ships. In the NBA playoffs, the Boston Celtics have advanced to the Eastern Conference Finals. The Celtics beat the Philadelphia 76ers in Game 7 of their playoff series last night. Doug Trabu reports from member station WBUR.
The Celtics led for most of the game, but the 76ers kept it close before falling by a score of 85-75. Point guard Rajon Rondo guided Boston in the fourth quarter, scoring 11 of his 18 points. With the win, the Celtics advanced to face LeBron James and the Heat. Celtics coach Doc Rivers says after a seven-game series, there's not much time for his players to rest.
But I love where we're at. I told them after the game, this is exactly where we thought we would be, and we're going to Miami.
The Heat and Celtics will play Game 1 in Miami Monday night. Tonight, the Western Conference Finals begin with the San Antonio Spurs hosting the Oklahoma City Thunder. For NPR News, I'm Doug Tribou in Boston.
The Indianapolis 500 is underway. The car race traditionally runs the day before Memorial Day. This is believed to be the most wide-open race in years. There are no clear favorites. Last year's winner, Dan Weldon, was killed in an accident in October. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Today we have as our guest someone I've been eager to have in the studio with me for quite some time, Dan Schiller, professor in the Graduate School of Library and Information Sciences, author of numerous books, all of which were trailblazing in the field of communication and information studies and history and policy, one of the really outstanding historians of communication of our times. Joining us for the full hour, Dan, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks, Bob. Glad to be here.
Well, you know, there's so much to talk about. We're going to sort of cover the lay of the land in today's show, in this conversation. But the one thing, I mean, your work, going back really to the late 70s, early 80s, one of the areas that I think, for me at least, and I think for most scholars in the field of communication and study media, you were one of the first who really understood the importance of telecommunication. And nowadays, that seems passé. We all get it. But in 1981 or 2 or 3, really until the World Wide Web came along, I don't think people fully understood the significance of telecommunication and its relationship to the whole broader information media system. And just for people who are probably wondering about that, what is telecommunication? What has its role been historically? And then how does it relate to media? How does this fit in today?
Telecommunications has been a crucial part of the American experience and, in fact, the world experience for hundreds of years. And it all depends on how we define it, as you asked me to. It basically means point-to-point communication at a distance. That's what it means originally.
Tele is Greek for distance.
Distance and then communication. It could be different types of media that are used. The transmission systems can be different. The forms of sending messages can be different. And for many purposes, we need to begin any appraisal of telecommunications historically with the post office, which seems remote from our world of electrons dancing around in the atmosphere or on fiber optic cables. But in many ways, it both set out the capabilities and the institutional structures that have endured or been modified ever since. And I know we share a deep appreciation for the work that's been done by, for example, historian Richard John on the postal contributions to not only the economy but also the American polity and culture. Going back a long way.
To the beginning.
To the beginning.
Yeah,
and
literally.
In fact, the policy solutions that were adapted to the post office in the American experience in opposition to the monarchy of Britain proved to have an enduring significance for the good, the true, and the beautiful in American history, you could say. They were ingenious and in many ways progressive solutions. No invasion of privacy, the subsidy for certain categories of material that needed to go in order to educate the citizenry in the lessons of democracy.
Specifically newspapers.
Specifically newspapers, but also government documents. Yeah. I mean, the whole range of things that needed to be part of the discourse of unfolding democracy, limited though it was in that early period.
Yeah.
So the post office sets the terms. Then you get the telegraph. And the telegraph is almost a negative reference model with regard to the post office. The post office, by and large, is a positive model. The telegraph, by and large, a negative model.
How come?
Because the telegraph, to put a point on it, was one of the first nationwide corporate monopolies. It was beholden not to any larger public purpose, but...
Now, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I can't help at this point. You know, the telegraph in Britain and other countries was like the post office. It was a national service. Why didn't the United States go the route of every other country in the mid-19th century and do the same thing?
Well, there's a lot of learning behind your question already, and it's probably worth reminding the audience or mentioning to the audience that it's true that the United States was exceptional in regards to the ownership and control of the telecommunications system, beginning with the telegraph in the mid to late 19th century. All of the major trading partners of the United States proved to go towards government ownership and control, and they vested the wondrous telegraph and then the telephone after it in a ministry of communications, a post office ministry, usually it was originally called. Why did this happen? Well, we need to do, I think, further research on this issue, but Richard, John has done some, I've done some, other historians have done some, and the answer in brief is that the power of private capital over this industry in the United States simply overawed other interests, political and social, which is not to say that other interests didn't exist. There was a really strong pro-nationalization movement around the telegraph at the end of the 19th century. It was seen as comparable to the big banks and particularly to the railroads in its ability to, let's say, disequilibrate the American political economy, to put poorer people, working people, even small businesses at a disadvantage compared to the big nationwide corporations that were forming at that time.
You know, I think you can draw a line from the telegraph to telephone right through to the internet today, and I think you're already showing that line. And just for a second, talk a little bit about what exactly it was about a private monopoly over telegraph like Western Union had. I mean, what exactly in the ground, if you lived in America in 1885, what did that actually mean as opposed to maybe it having been run by the post office or something?
Well, I'll give you, there are a number of examples one could give. I'll offer one that seems salient in the context of today's continuing financial and economic crisis. The telegraph in the 1880s became mostly monopolized by Western Union. Western Union was the single largest, by far, provider of telegraph services, and it approached a monopoly more closely than probably any other major company at that time.
And Western Union has what they call network effects, meaning that, you know, it's awfully hard to have seven different competing telegraph companies, each with their own customers, because the largest one is the one any rational person wants to belong to. Everyone floods to the largest, and no one can compete with
it. It's more efficient, even if you have to pay an extortionate rate for that.
Because at least you can communicate with people.
Yes.
Someone else is on
yes.
the network.
Yeah, nobody else has it. But this monopoly was procured only by very, very sleazy sorts of financial and political dealings. So, for example, Western Union had mutually exclusive ties with the big railroad companies, so they got access to the rights of way, and the railroad got to use their telegraph service at preferred rates, and the only deal was that nobody else could provide telegraph service. So that was one mutually exclusive dealing. The other one was with the Associated Press, where
Western... A very important part of journalism history,
absolutely.
You're about to explain.
Absolutely. And I mean, through this means, Western Union was able to taint in the pejorative sense of that term, the public discourse about the issue of whether the telegraph ought to be postalized.
And to explain, I mean, as I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, because this is your turf, the Associated Press was the wire service that sent news to all the newspapers in the country that were participants, and included most of the major newspapers, not all, but most. And the deal was that Western Union wouldn't allow anyone else to set up a wire service, so Associated Press was the only one, which meant that the newspapers that people relied on for information about the telegraph and telegraph policy were beholden to Western Union for protecting their monopoly.
Well, and in fact, it was, you're saying it exactly right. There's another dimension, which is that an Associated Press franchise was not something that was freely on offer to all newspaper proprietors. It was a scarce...
So it gave you a distinct advantage over whatever competition you might have in your market.
Because you got foreign news. You got, meaning out of the locality news.
Yeah, or Washington News,
Washington
or New
News,
York.
Washington News, all over the place.
Yeah.
So this was a scarce commodity, and both Western Union and the Associated Press used it to good advantage to procure the kinds of ideological results that they favored in the public discourse.
So you can see right away, I mean, it just gets clear, this is getting the crosshairs of people at the bottom end of the packing marching order.
Absolutely. And working people in the late 19th century hated Western Union, and there were a lot of other issues. But let me mention one other one, which I think has, as I said, particular relevance to our own time, which is that the guy who ran Western Union in the 1880s was probably one of the most hated business figures in American history.
Most reprehensible.
I mean, Jay Gould.
Yeah.
And in fact, I grew up, I heard songs about Jay Gould in the 1950s.
So, he was the epitome of robber baron.
He's a robber baron par excellence, yeah. You know? And so what did he do? Well, condensing a sorry and detailed story into its essentials, he had a railroad. He had a big railroad system that he owned. And he therefore had a right-of-way around the railroad tracks. So he announces to the press, I'm going to start a telegraph company to compete with Western Union. So what's the likely result of that? The result is Western Union's stock share price goes down. Jay Gould then buys a big chunk of Western Union at the depressed price and forces Western Union to buy his fledgling telegraph company at inflated prices, okay? So it worked really well. And in fact, Jay Gould found it worked so well that he did it again. And this time he sets up a really big company to compete with Western Union. He says, I really mean it this time. He makes Western Union swallow the company and he becomes the head of Western Union through that transaction. That's really shady dealing.
Yeah, so this wraps everything up into a ball.
Yeah, I mean, and it's one that I would say has some relevance for some of the things we see in an often more sort of opaque way around the behavior of Goldman Sachs and some of the other financial companies these days. But then there was no structure of countervailing government power. Mm-hmm. This is the big difference back then, going back to your question about how was he able to get away with this. When in the 1860s, the U.S. Senate requested that Western Union come in to testify on issues that had to do with the ownership and control of the telegraph and the preferential rates and all of the other things that we've talked about. This is the 1860s. Western Union just said no.
Was this right after the war or during the war?
This was right after the war, as I remember, right after the war. They just said no. And there was no way that the government had set up to do anything about that. So it took decades for there to be created the sorts of regulatory institutions, however inadequate, and they were inadequate, that could supply some sort of restraint over this kind of behavior.
And so they really had no, like, and we're going to talk about the telephone in a second, but the Western Union had no obligations for universal service, no price regulation. They were a flat-out, full-scale monopoly, no holds barred. They could do whatever they wanted to maximize profit.
Pretty much. And so as a result of that, a couple of things. The contemporary estimates by knowledgeable insiders were that the 5% of the American population at most made use of the telegraph service. 5%. That was because the rates were extortionary. If you go to other parts of the world, you found modestly at least better rates, particularly in some of the smaller industrialized countries like Belgium or
And to put it in the context, if Jay Gould had somehow been able to take over the American Post Office, probably would have raised postage prices tenfold. Well, we would have had a similar outcome there.
Or at least he would have said if that's in his interest.
If that's the profit-maximizing
move, that's what he would try to do.
Exactly.
And so for decades, the telegraph, the only time an ordinary person ever got a telegram as if a family member had died. I mean, telegraph messengers were feared people because yeah. They come to the door and it means, oh my goodness, somebody's ill. Somebody's about to go.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Dan Schiller, professor in the Graduate School of Library and Information Sciences here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We pre-recorded this show about 5 weeks before going on air, so please don't call in today. Let us do the talking. Dan Schiller is the author of numerous books, Information, Policy, History, and The Nature of Capitalism. We'll be talking about the corpus of his work and having a conversation for the rest of the hour. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. The telegraph just dominated the late 19th century. And I think today, even people my age, and I'm dating myself here, the telegraph's sort of a vague memory. You see it in movies or in literature. But it was, like the Google of the 19th century, the late 19th century. It was such a dominant monopoly and firm. But it did go away. It was eventually replaced or surpassed by the telephone. And what's different, what's similar and what's different about how telephone emerged in the United States?
Well, the telephone, let me go back to something I said before. There were two models for telecommunication system development on offer in 1880, 1890, 1900. One of them was around the post office, which was inclusive, relatively democratic, relatively non-discriminatory. There were abuses, but, you know, that's, I think, a fair statement. And on the other hand, there was the Telegraph, which was massively self-interested and discriminatory and in all sorts of ways corrupting.
And completely unaccountable.
And unaccountable. So these were the two models. And for contemporaries at that time, because that's when the telephone began to emerge, the great question was, which direction is it going to go? Mm-hmm. Is it going to be like the Telegraph? And don't forget, the base, the biggest unit of capital in the telephone industry had two T's in its name, American Telephone and Telegraph.
That's right.
So there was a very clear sense that the telephone industry might be headed towards the telegraph model, and a lot of people didn't want that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
That feeds into the historical process. The awareness of the damage done around the telegraph feeds into the historical process, even though there were very powerful actors who did prefer to push the telephone in that sort of a direction. But the guy who took over at AT&T in 1907, after having been there in its first years in the 1870s and early 80s, and then departing for two decades.
And just before you introduce Mr. Vail, if you could just for a timeline for our listeners, when does telephone come in, and when is it becoming sort of a widespread medium?
Telephone is invented in the 1870s. That's a contested sort of a historical issue. The patent rights are important from the very beginning, but it's invented in the 1870s. It goes through a very, very important, but in social terms, undeveloped process of expansion in the first 17 years when it's straight patent control that mm-hmm. sets the terms. And the capital investment that's required for the telephone goes beyond any prior telecommunications system. Mm-hmm. It's vast. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of considerations about why it doesn't grow as fast as it subsequently does. But when the patents lapse in the 1890s, there's a process of prolific expansion for the next 15 years or so, 20 years. Yet even after that, and so we're into the World War I period by now, even after that, we're talking maybe 20% of American households have the telephone. My grandparents got the telephone in New York City, which is important to say because it's a population center, so it's not some remote area where they haven't strung a wire,
mm-hmm.
In 1941 in World War II.
Do they have a party line?
I'm not sure whether they did have a party line. A lot of people did.
Yeah, my relatives had party lines.
So party lines, that's something probably most of your listenership doesn't even know what that is.
They're lucky not to, believe me, having used one.
Well, it's also a way of, if you don't have television, you can find out what's happening in the drama of
other people. It's the early Facebook, early social media, because you share a phone line.
Yeah,
so literally only
absolutely.
A bunch of houses are sharing the same phone line.
Anyway, so the telephone goes through a long process. But in terms of whether it's going to follow post office or telephone, it ends up going in a third direction that borrows elements of both of those two. And the key terms are that the guy who ran AT&T in this decisive period of its development, Theodore Vail, was willing to accept government regulation on the company and even learn how to use it to achieve corporate objectives. And this meant that he was a very far-sighted and thoughtful, even a visionary business leader, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
He was probably somebody, I'm not sure how to evaluate the actual capabilities of some of our own generation of business leaders. But
mm-hmm.
I think Bill Gates is a smart man.
Mm-hmm.
I think Steve Jobs was a smart man.
Yeah.
These guys are, you know, capable. And they're like Vail in this sort of way. They have a vision of where they want to go, and they have great flexibility.
They're not ideologues.
They're not ideologues. They're really willing to say, look, we can accept some things that previous generations have said flat out no to, like the Jay Goulds, mm-hmm. in order to get where we hope to go. Vail was like that. And so he acquiesced and even helped, beyond acquiescing, pioneer some of the mechanisms of state public utility regulation, which definitely did provide a public venue for evaluating some of the policies that AT&T preferred on its own, and in occasional cases to restrict them. Not in any way as often as reformers hoped, but
mm-hmm.
enough of the time that it was different from mm-hmm. in the older form.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, the main difference of the phone company, the restrictions on it, what it had to do, and AT&T got basically a monopoly similar to Western Union and had it until 1984, to get this incredibly lucrative monopoly over the telephone service. Two things that seemingly had to do that Western Union didn't have to do, and they're very important, I think, for the internet debates today. One is provide service to everyone who wanted it. So you couldn't just ignore rural areas and poor neighborhoods because they weren't profitable. Part of the deal was you get a monopoly, you've at least got to wire up people who want to have a telephone.
Although I got to say, I mean, AT&T for decades let independent telephone companies do that.
Do that, yeah.
And it was only much later that they integrated into that.
But the principle was there.
Yes.
And the other principle is that they couldn't discriminate against users, right? Unlike Western Union, that was part of the whole model.
Absolutely.
They had to let everyone have access to the network and had to share the same basic price for the same service.
That's true, with one important qualification, which is that all telecommunications systems have made privileged room for business users.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's true that in any given
In
any given class of service, the telephone industry is not allowed to discriminate. And mm-hmm. that's a historical advance over the telegraph that's really important.
Yeah.
That said, businesses were systematically privileged over residential users. And I'll give you an example, even going back to the post office for that. In the 1890s, because that has bearing on our current issues about the post office. In the 1890s, in the financial district of New York City, there were pickup and delivery by the post office every 10 minutes. So
every 10 minutes.
You can't tell me that it's not
every 10 minutes.
Every 10 minutes. It's not possible to say that it's just inherently inefficient because it's a government monopoly. It depends on the historical need for the service.
I had no idea it was every 10 minutes. I knew that there was multiple times a day, 7 days a week even, in our major cities.
Well, that's what I've read. So, I mean, you know, it's one statistic. But the advantage that was proffered to businesses and in particular banks in this context for the post office, as long as they really needed the post office at that time, was considerable. And that has ramified through subsequent telecommunication systems, and it's still there with the Internet today, and we can perhaps talk about that if you like.
Our guest, Dan Schiller. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, on WILL AM 580. We pre-recorded this show 5 weeks before going on air, so please don't call in. Sit back, relax, and let us through the show. Let's talk a little bit about the post office, since you just raised it. It is now, in the year 2012, in the midst of an existential crisis. It's under threat to be closed down, eliminated. And I know for me, this is a very important issue still. But what do you say to those who say, look, we've got the Internet. We've got digital communication revolution. It's really an enormous unneeded expense to have this infrastructure of buildings in every zip code. The enormous expense of people trudging around 6 days a week to every residence and every business address in the country dropping off mail, that it's really no longer can be justified. I mean, we've gone past that. It's the horse and buggy of our times.
Well, there are many possible responses to that. And I think it's probably important to begin by saying that in some respects, the world has indeed moved on. And there needs to be acknowledgement that whatever kinds of solutions are proposed and actualized, we don't want to be put into an either-or kind of way of looking at some of the new possibilities. They're too deeply entrenched in people's daily lives already. But I want to begin the answer by remembering something that most people don't know, which is that the post office tried to implement electronic mail inside the post office in the late 1970s.
Hmm.
The post office was one of the originators of a concept of electronic mail at a moment when it was still a fledgling and even a completely specialized marginal service.
I mean, for the public or just for internally?
Well, originally they tried to do it for big corporations as users, but they had the hope of going beyond that to the wider population. And you have to remember, nobody in the 1970s had a vision of email as a general utility for all people. It was not something that had yet proven itself, you know, beyond the military and some specialized computer science departments then. Post office tried to originate an electronic mail service called ECOM, Electronic Computer Originated Mail, was what the acronym stood for. And they were roundly devastated for this and pushed back by the private communications companies that wanted to be in that market. Some of them are names that no longer ring contemporarily today, but they were titans of telecommunications. We're talking here again. A much weakened Western Union was involved in this, RCA, ITT. All of them wanted to be the ones that offered email.
Mm-hmm.
And they lobbied effectively to force the post office out of that service. So when we look at the question today of the post office being a relic, first of all, I would say it's not a relic, and we can talk about that in a minute. But secondly, to the extent that it has been superannuated, that's a deliberate result of the last 30, 40 years of political economic change in telecommunications.
Well, I think I didn't know this about the post office in the late 70s. This is a breaking story, everyone. Now, the listeners of this show have increased exponentially the number of people who are familiar with that part of the story. It's incredible. But this gets to the whole issue of the ISPs and gets back to telecommunications because sort of the idea of the post office as an alternative or a public alternative because, to me, one of the most amazing stories of the past 20 years is how you have a digital revolution that basically eliminates the need of landline telephones, which we're in the process of losing. And you go from a situation, and theoretically it's going to create all this new competition. In the 1990s, that was the huge promise in telecommunication. And you go from a situation where we had between the baby bells that had local monopolies and the long-distance companies and a few others, maybe 12 to 15 viable telecommunication companies in the early 1990s that were serious companies among the Fortune 400. And Fortune 500. And then today we're in a situation where we basically have two companies that dominate, still phone companies, but dominate mobile communication, where the future of the internet is clearly going at 100 miles an hour. Yeah. They completely dominate it with a duopoly. It's far less competitive. And cable broadband, which is sort of going to have the line into the home, dominated is a monopoly everywhere in the country. And there's only a few companies that rule that, primarily Comcast. So we have this incredibly monopolized system. And the ISP market's been taken over by the same people who, going back to telegraph and telephone, and it's concentrated, monopolistic, and more powerful than ever. It's an extraordinary story, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's a resurgence of the same things that brought us the telegraph and the telephone after it in a modified form. But I'd say, in some respects, it's a retreat from the era of the telephone because the mechanisms of regulatory restraint have been modified in a negative way.
Yeah, under the guise of deregulation, 1990s said, well, the market will provide all the public service. It'll force firms to serve the public, so we don't need to ever have these regulations like we had on AT&T in the past.
But see, I've got to say one other thing, which is that I see in the internet market or in the modern telecommunications industry that we experience today, it's true that the power of the big carriers, the Verizons and the AT&Ts, is formidable, and it needs to be checked, and it needs to be scrutinized, and it needs to be accountable. Absolutely. But if you look at the profit chains, if you look at where the major profits are going for telecommunications services and the internet, I'm inclined to say you want to include in the purview of actors that require that same set of regulatory and accountability mechanisms to foreground Apple, Google, Facebook, and some of the other titans of the service dimension of the internet. Because the extent to which, let's include another one, Microsoft. Microsoft owns Skype.
Yeah,
bought Skype a year or two ago, cost them by telecommunications deals a very modest sum of, I think it was $8 billion.
They took out their spare change drawer.
Yeah, I mean, it's for them, they could do it.
Yeah.
But by comparison, the big mergers of the 1990s that you were mentioning a moment ago that reduced the number of carriers, many of those were an order of magnitude larger, because that was what seemed to be needed to retain market power at that time.
Yeah.
Well, Skype, for $8 billion, has more international voice telephone traffic, or voice message traffic, we could say, than the rest of the international carriers combined in terms of the growth rates that have occurred over the last few years. Skype is head and shoulders above that, and that's now just a property of Microsoft. We need mechanisms of making accountable to public policy, to democratic need, these other firms. And I know that's an anathema. Most people think, well, don't let the market touch it. Don't let the government touch it because the market's doing such a good job. I'm not persuaded of that.
Well, this is an area I'm writing about, as you know, right now. In fact, the chapter I'm writing this moment deals exactly with these, what I haven't come up with this term, but sort of the feudalization of the internet, which is we have, it seems like, between Microsoft and Apple and Amazon and Facebook and Google, for starters. I think those are probably the big five.
Yes, I agree.
And they each have their own clouds that store all the data, which is where a lot of the power is now. Each of these five, and they're all based around monopolies. And they have sort of this protective monopoly terms. It's like if you're battling for control of the world, each monopoly, each of them has a continent.
Yeah.
It's their home base, but they protect it. And they make their killer profits there. And then they can use that to collect money, make surgical strikes to attack their opponents or to try to buy up any potential new continents that come along. But they all have monopoly power. By any any criteria economists have ever used or antitrust evaluators have ever used. And it's really changing the nature of all the sort of public rhetoric we've had, our understanding of the not just competitive, but the open nature of the internet.
Absolutely.
It seems like we're rapidly going toward a period where the open internet is going to be just this, have as much relevance as stories about the invisible hand have to explain markets.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you're right. And I think we will all await this chapter and the book that it's a part of, because there's a
especially
lot of...
my publisher.
Well, there's a lot of crucial stuff, and it's happening very rapidly. And most people, because of, in a way, paradoxically, the entrenched quality of the internet and everyday experience now, it's almost elusive to put your fingers on the or your hands around these changes that are occurring right behind that.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the level of, okay, I'm going to go check the weather, or I'm going to go make a transaction on Amazon, or I'm going to
check out some movie star.
Check out a movie star on Facebook. You know, I mean, it doesn't seem to make any difference.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that there aren't these very almost architectonic changes occurring that will, over time, make a profound impact on the social experience and the capabilities of internet functions. So, yes.
Our guest, Dan Schiller. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580 coming to you today with a recorded show taped about 5 weeks before we've been on air. So please don't call and sit back, relax, and let Dan Schiller and me do the yakking. Dan, and this gets to something else I think that, as I've done my research, has been striking. And this actually goes back to work your father, Herb Schiller, one of the giants of communication research and a wonderful man, that he really pioneered, which is the importance of the military the communication system in the United States. And with the internet, you know, when I read all these books from my book, and every book after book, that's barely mentioned. You wouldn't even know we have a standing army in the United States. You know, you think we're Costa Rica. Yet if you look at the internet, what everything's going on with it, you see the military's thumbprints, handprint, grip everywhere.
I couldn't agree more, and that's been true from the beginning. What the myth that we hear, or that, you know, people tell, is that the military relaxed control in the 1980s. The internet, as we know it, was then free to develop as a civilian project. And you know, there is, as with many myths, a kernel of truth in this, in the sense that there was then a splitting, a bifurcation of the internet in the 1980s, and a specific military type internet called MILNET was hived off for the specialized needs of the military. But that didn't mean the military kept its hands off the rest of the system. And that's exercised in a very shadowy way by different agencies in the control structure over the internet. What we need to start from in even beginning to evaluate this is the seemingly peculiar and even wrongheaded claim that the internet has a control structure. And in fact, it does. It comes to a point in something called the domain name system, which is the organizational framework for providing what are called critical internet resources, meaning web addresses and blocks of web addresses and network addresses that are embedded in the routers that that run the internet and that exchange messages across it, whether it's email or Facebook traffic or search queries or whatever. These addresses are prized. They have to be operationally revised and controlled to reflect every change that's made, and there are changes made across the world virtually every second of every day to this. So who runs the servers over which those addresses are run and on which they're stored? Well, there are specialized companies that run them. .com is run by a company called VeriSign. And VeriSign is a pretty big company in Washington or in Virginia, and it's pretty well co-located with the military and intelligence community.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But we don't have research on their direct ties.
Yeah.
But that there are such ties is undoubted.
Well, we're seeing right now, and when I'm seeing research, it's not barely talked about. It's come up in the popular press, even Wired magazine. The ability of the national security infrastructure, the intelligence community, the military, the police, the FBI, to access basically anything they want online, to be blunt, you know, and the cooperation of private monopolies like Google and Facebook with these requests. And sometimes they don't even need a request because the access, they can just bypass them.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we heard a huge sort of firestorm of publicity when Google stood up to the Chinese government in 2010, whenever it was, and said, we're not going to offer service here under the terms that you're insisting that we offer it because of government censorship and surveillance. Yeah. It would be a very important thing for someone to look at what the practice is here and to see if they could create a firestorm of publicity about that.
Don't hold your breath. I think the link between the military, the government, and these firms is far too strong that they're going to like basically end their business model or put it in jeopardy to stand up for that principle.
I agree with you. But they're pervasive links. We need to know what they are, not only because of some concern about the military as a shadowy and unaccountable entity, which it is, but also because of the follow-on, the knock-on effects. Well, historically, once there's this sort of structural tie that allows, let's say, in this case, the military to have access to all kinds of stuff that otherwise is separated, it's not, there's no database matching, there's less of it. Once the military is institutionally placed to be able to do that, or the security agencies,
intelligence,
cops. It will follow, as night follows day, that commercial companies will then find new room to do the same thing.
And they are doing that. And also, there's an industry buildup of commercial companies to provide the government with this information that can get it even better.
Absolutely.
And then once you get the profit motive and institutions that they're making money at something, it's almost it's much harder to ever extricate it.
Yeah, then we'll be able to have basically innocuous debates over invasion of privacy when the issue that will be posed to us is secondary at the best rather than structural. They're building in massive invasion of privacy as a ubiquitous feature of the internet that you're talking about, presided over by just a few companies and the military agencies on the government side. And this is an area where Americans have in poll after poll shown that they care very, very deeply that the system not be used in this sort of pernicious way. So you go on the internet and suddenly you see there's an ad for a pair of shoes following you on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
You go from place to place and yet those shoes are there every time.
Yeah.
Well, that's a sort of trivial example of the thing we're talking about, but the capacity that's built into the system to track you that allows that to happen is anything but trivial. And it has to do with the most precious rights that we as Americans share across the left to right spectrum.
Oh, no, that's right. This traditionally was as much a right issue as a left issue. Or not as much, but there were elements of the right that
absolutely
were certainly as concerned.
So it raises, are. I mean, I think on this issue that you could make this a presidential level campaign issue and get the American people behind some form of regulatory mechanism to make this kind of system capability less possible.
Yet there's no evidence that anyone's going to be doing anything remotely close to that in either major political party. In fact, as far as I can tell, both leaders of both parties are pretty much in the exact opposite direction, rhetoric notwithstanding, in terms of actions and what they're actually doing. And this gets to some of the areas you've worked on, which is the policymaking process. I mean, what for listeners who might naively think that if the majority of people want something, that it would eventually filter its way through to policymakers, and that's what you get. Clearly, I think all the evidence says that most Americans want tremendous amounts of privacy. They don't want an invasion of their privacy online. Yet we're going very quickly in the other direction. Why is that? Why isn't that reflected in Washington and policymaking?
Well, I've got to say, Bob, that this is really an area where your expertise goes beyond mine. And so I'm going to put you on the hot seat and reverse our pattern
here.
I'm
the host here.
But I do. I mean, I want to acknowledge that in trying to respond to you, because much of what I can say about this is drawn from your own work. I think that there are numerous points in the political economy of the internet and more generally public discourse in the United States where private interests are able to secure for themselves special privileges and to use those positions of strength to lobby very effectively for whatever they perceive to be in their interest going forward. So, for example, on the political discourse at the presidential level continues in each cycle to require more and more fundraising because of what? Because of the need to find money to pay the media to have access to the public.
Yeah.
The television, the web.
Well, primarily television.
But primarily television. And so the electoral spending goes out of control. I mean, it wildly defies any notion of accountability that this sort of spending should be required in an election. And there's a very simple solution to it, and you've proposed one that I think would work very, very well, and I'll let you say that in a minute.
No, go ahead and say it. I don't know which one it is. I come up with so many crazy ideas.
Well, no, I wouldn't say this is crazy. But you could just say in your tax return, you can allocate a dollar or two every year in your tax return to public support for media spending.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one piece of an answer.
Yeah.
You could even – that's actually a regressive kind of a taxation. You could say that rich people should pay more in order to have public accountability. But at any rate, I know that's probably too far out. The control structure is such that the ability to get the message out is confined to I won't say the margins, because there have been, and it's important to acknowledge this, some good developments in the last 10 or 15 years.
There have been some victories, but the playing field sloped.
It's
heavily sloped. In fact, I was just talking to a leading activist in Washington who works on internet policy, I won't give his name only because I didn't ask him for permission. It was a confidential call. But I can tell you what he said. I said, well, how will it affect your organizing, depending on who wins the presidential election, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, and your work on control over the internet? And he said, and the quote was, and he was half joking, but only half joking, he said, it'll determine whether ATD is overtly or covertly writing the next law, depending on which party wins. That's really what it comes down to. But they're going to be writing the next law no matter who wins. Or they're people like them. He's using that as a catchphrase for those behemoths we were talking about.
So, I mean, we need to try to get in there and make a difference to make that harder. And
what are some of the issues you think that listeners who are concerned with, in your mind, looking right now and then ahead the next 2, 3, 4 years as far as visible future, what are some of the great political decisions, policy decisions that are going to be coming up that will shape the future of digital communication?
Well, I'll just give another plug on the way into that for the discussion of privacy. Privacy is not a good name for what's happening. It's when you have a transgression of privacy, you're talking about basically a government agency of some sort intruding on the sphere of an individual. That's what a transgression of privacy is historically, and it's subject to various legal checks and restraints. The scale on which privacy transgression is occurring today defies that conceptual container because it's for the whole culture.
Yeah.
And so we need a way of talking about it that doesn't reduce it down that way
Good point. Do you have what's a better word? I'll start using it.
Well, let's come up with one because I'd like to use it too.
And I think you think of privacy as someone opening your mail and see what you wrote to your grandmother or
something.
Well,
you can almost call it a kind of cultural strip mining.
Yeah.
I
like that more.
It's basically working at the whole cultural level to harvest data of interest to private interest, private companies, regardless of whose sphere they intrude on. And we need a way of talking about this that raises it, elevates it to the level of seriousness that it has.
Yeah, that's a really great point.
So that's the first thing I would say.
Yeah.
But there are other ones. And the problem is, Bob, that these get very quickly into murky and opaque areas of technological.
In the weeds.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I would say that in a way, one policy issue that I think would be critical is trying to insist that the American people have access to non-technical discourse that explains what's going on with the internet. So in its own right, that there be a, let's say, I call it in my teaching and in my faculty meetings, an information observatory. We need an information observatory in this country simply to provide to the American population unbiased, factually anchored information about the telecommunications system, and in particular the internet, in all of its relevant policymaking directions, so that people are able to form a deeper understanding of the questions that they need to be involved in answering.
Do any other countries have anything like this, do you know?
The European Union has an audiovisual observatory, which is pretty remote from ordinary people, and which doesn't, as far as I know, make a point of trying to provide ordinary language expertise to people. But we need what you're doing on this show magnified across the length and breadth, and in a way institutionalized, so that you can have access to the data that is necessary for effective democratic accountability in the system. Right now, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, which is charged with regulation over just one increasingly small piece of the internet, because it abdicated from its regulatory responsibilities a long time ago and you know, beat its breasts and gave itself big applause for doing so on the grounds that it was allowing the market to do what it wanted to do. Mm-hmm. The Federal Communications Commission gets an increasing share of its data from the very companies it's supposed to be regulating. Mm-hmm. This is back to the 19th century with Western Union.
No, it's been a real problem all along that the data they've got is highly dubious on the most important issues.
Yeah, so we need – I mean, this may sound like something that's so obtuse that the listenership couldn't care less, but we need, as a part of our democratic inheritance, to insist that the data on which policy is founded are not self-interestedly procured and that they are public.
Well, let's go to one other issue, and this is another issue where we could use some good data. The matter of copyright.
Good.
It has been an issue. It's similar to telecommunications, I'd say. Until the 1990s, copyright was a backwater of communication study. It was for lawyers and sort of industry people. But not many people had that much attention to it. Certainly I didn't, I'll be honest. And then now suddenly it's maybe an issue of singular importance to the extent that by the end of last year, literally millions of people were protesting proposed copyright law. And if someone told me 20 years ago there'd be millions of people protesting copyright law, I would have said you're living in a parallel universe. There's connection to this one. Yeah. So why is that? Why is copyright so important now? And what's at stake?
Well, this is a profound question. And I know you've been working, again, in the book you're doing now on this same question. But a number of scholars have written very, very important works treating different elements of the growing contestation over copyright. The basic issue is that over the last century, owners of copyrights, like owners of some other forms, patents and trademarks, have been able to stockpile the ownership of various kinds of media properties through the means of copyright on a scale that defies the imagination. So you take any of the big media companies, the Viacom or News Corporation, Disney, Time Warner. These companies have tens of thousands of copyrights.
And copyrights are monopoly licenses the government gives them so no one else can take this material and use it without their permission.
Absolutely. And those licenses have
increased. And they're meant to prevent free markets.
They're meant to prevent free markets, and they're meant to let's give them their due. They're meant to provide an incentive for creative work
that's
to
right.
occur.
And that's the reason it's in the first place.
That's
going
the
back to the Constitution.
Going back to the Constitution. So these companies have stockpiled tens of thousands of copyrights over television shows, musical recordings, everything, even news articles, to try to use them to leverage their profit strategies going forward. The internet has created a challenge for them in terms of this strategy because of the ease of reproduction and distribution of anything that can take a digital form, including work that's under copyright. So there is a kind of structural conflict, you could say, between the owners of these copyrights and other equally self-interested companies who use the internet to accomplish other sorts of things, Google or Facebook or Spotify or whomever it's going to be.
Yeah.
And so these increasingly sharp conflicts are coming to the fore between these different units of business who have different structural interests in regard to the way the internet should be used. The question that, however, we tend not to reach, although you reach it, is how should we finance cultural production?
Yeah.
That's the question that is beneath this question.
Let's talk about a tangible issue of this, because the music industry is probably the first one that got killed by this, because, you know, for a generation or two, especially with CDs when they came in the late 80s, the cost of actually producing music is virtually non-existent. Once you've recorded it, each marginal copy of a CD is hardly anything, but it costs $15-$20 to buy one. And so the profit, and the research of this is amazing, the profit that these industries were making, these monopoly rights to music, are off the charts. So the internet comes along and makes it possible to send a copy of the music, flawless digital form, exactly what you pay for free, just hitting enter. You send it to everyone in your book. And it sort of blows up the ability to have this exceptionally lucrative monopoly. And for a lot of people, 10 years ago, it looked like the music industry, well, this is a horse and buggy industry. Their history now, music's going to a new phase because it will be accessible to everyone for free online. And what, I mean, what's happened in the music industry since then, and what are the lessons for how this is going to play out, do you think?
Well, I mean, what's happened is that the industry has pursued a strategy of ferocious legal and technical innovation, where they use their still considerable resources, because the music industry is embedded in cultural conglomerates that have other sources of money, all the big music majors, and there's now, I think, globally only three left.
Yeah, there are three left.
Who all of them are embedded in companies like, well, you probably know better than I would, but Universal or Time Warner or Sony.
Yeah.
They do two things. One, they try to harass ordinary users for downloading music illicitly by tracking them. And they have to procure in that process the acquiescence of the ISPs, Internet service providers, to do that. So that raises, again, the question of surveillance and that we were talking about before. And they go after the weak link in the system, which is some poor teenager who's been downloading musical files illicitly. And they say, okay, you owe us $5,000 or $50,000. Yeah. And, you know, that's an object.
They send really scary letters to the parents.
Yeah, and so that uses mechanisms of social control to try to induce change.
What about, like, iPods and iPads? You know?
Well, that's the other thing I was going to mention. They've increasingly moved towards a proprietary environment. They build platforms like iPods or iPhones or iPads or other devices, other just mobile phones in general, smartphones in general, that are not operating the way the open internet used to operate. These are operating with much greater, again, surveillance and control by a kind of cartel of music companies and equipment providers, service providers, Apple and so forth. So Apple horns in, takes off 30% of the sales revenue through the iTunes store, and the music companies then have a protected channel, which they use through various kinds of technical means to make sure you can't copy the song over and over again once you download it onto your iPhone.
So they get a cut of the action, even though, I mean, technically they're doing nothing of value. They just own a monopoly right to something done 12 years ago.
They're providing a distribution channel in a convenient way. But you see, again, the point I want to drive toward here is that what this raises is the viability of a private system in the area of culture, a viability of a market-based system in culture. This raises, just like as your work shows in the newspaper industry, what economists call a public good nature of these kinds of
information in general or culture
is something that we need to find mechanisms of public finance.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not going to have an absence of music just because the music industry is put onto its knees.
Mm-hmm.
People are still playing music. People are still listening to music. The whole structure of music goes back thousands of years in humankind's history.
Yeah.
It's not going to end. They try to confuse us about that by saying, well, you're not going to have our music industry in the internet to come if it goes in an unchecked direction. But in fact, we need to think about how to fund culture in a way that preserves basic needs here. Not the needs of for-profit owners, the needs of the American people for a rich and, if I can indulge this, sonorous culture that will allow diversity of expression, allow creativity, allow a mixed culture, you could say, to flower.
Dan Schiller, we've only got about a little under 2 minutes left, and there's so much I still want to ask you. But I do want you to conclude, if you would, talk about your own work. What are you working on now? What's coming up in the Dan Schiller pipeline?
Well, thanks, Bob. I'm working on an area that has kept me going since 2008 with the financial crisis, which is currently under the title Digital Depression. And that is not about healthcare.
Well, that's depressing.
It could be, I suppose, but it's about the structure of the communications and information industry in the period of economic crisis that we continue to be in today. What are the contributions of the communications industry to the crisis? What are the possibilities for the communications industry coming out of the crisis? And that's set, as I think it needs to be, in an international context. So in a nutshell, that's what I'm trying to work on.
Well, I can hardly wait to see that, believe me. And then one last word. You've done a lot of work in China, so you have 60 seconds now to tell our listeners, you know, what they should know about China that might not be known. If there's one thing you say that you should understand about China, having been there and studied it.
Well, I mean, I think China is not just an authoritarian state. It is an authoritarian state, and we have much to be aware of about that. But it is also a population that is experiencing boiling change. Uncontainable change, and that is exerting pressures both on its own state and on the world in ways that we desperately need to understand better without bogeymen, without the
demonizing
China bashing that we hear. We need more one-on-one contact. We need more human-to-human contact with our counterparts in China because we could learn a lot from them.
Dan Schiller, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to come join us here at Media Matters.
It's a pleasure, Bob. Thank you.
And I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back with you in 167 hours with another Media Matters. Until then, everyone, have a great spring. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Today's weather forecast calls for sunny and hot conditions with a near record high around 95, mostly clear with a low of 72 for tonight. Tomorrow, Memorial Day, it should be mostly sunny, the high 92. Showers and thunderstorms likely tomorrow night, the low 68. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.